The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You have metering where they're only allowing a certain number every day, not everyone who just arrives. People get very frustrated. They don't want to wait. They can't wait. And they were crossing then along the river, and a lot of people were getting swept away by the river. And so then you need Border Patrol to go out there and rescue them. And so what's happening is that you're putting an extra strain on Border Patrol. Should Border Patrol then be getting more resources to rescue more people? Yes. But it's a problem that's caused by another CBP policy that's pushing people into those situations.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 2nd, 2019. Last month at the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin, Stephanie Loiter, director of the Mexico Security Initiative at the University of Texas, joined Bobby Chesney on stage to discuss an incredible new research project she has been doing on Lawfare. She and Sheriff Benny Martinez, who was also on stage and part of the discussion, have teamed up to study the large number of migrants who have died hiking in the brush in Brooks County, trying to evade a Border Patrol checkpoint in the county. Bobby Chesney, director of the Strauss Center at the University of Texas and a Lawfare co-founder, hosted the discussion, which covered a lot of ground, how Sheriff Martinez came to share a large quantity of data with Loiter on the many people who have died in his county, the challenges of search and rescue and body recovery operations in a rural county, and how Washington policy is making it all worse. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 467, In the Brush in Brooks County.
Sheriff, Professor, thank you both for being here today. Benny, how'd you meet Stephanie? How did the work you guys have done together begin?
She called the office to have an interview. So I think it took us maybe a couple of weeks to get it set up and get it going. And her and her colleague showed up and we sat down and started discussing the issue.
Do you get a lot of calls from academics, professors saying, hey, Sheriff, I want to come hang out with you. I got some questions for you.
Actually, she's the first one that has called.
Stephanie, are you in the habit of calling up sheriffs and asking them to open the doors and let you in?
Actually, yes. I have been doing that. But to go back to when I sat down first with Sheriff Martinez, it started off as a normal conversation. We were discussing migration dynamics in that part of South Texas. And then it took a turn for the beginning of our foundation when he kind of pushed across the desk a white binder that said on the cover, Human Remains 2018. Which is what you might imagine was all the case files of the people who had been discovered in the county during that time. And that binder began the project that took us here today.
What had you thought you were going to go in there to talk about? What were you working on at that point?
I was curious to know more about, we've been here in the U.S. recently in the past few years, we've been talking so much about the families and the unaccompanied minors who show up at the border. But I had read in a few other news articles where Sheriff Martinez had spoken to journalists about all the people who were passing the border, getting on the highway, getting up to the CBP checkpoint. And then instead of going through the checkpoint, they were going around through the ranch land. And so many of them were dying. And so I wanted to know more about this phenomena of what actually was happening in Brooks County. And so that's why I picked up the phone. He was the first sheriff that I had called. I have now called subsequent sheriffs.
All right, so for those who don't know their South Texas geography, we're talking about 70 miles from the border. Brooks County is not on the border, but in a very real, practical sense, the border is much more than just the actual physical crossing point. So, Sheriff, how is it What explains why so many people are coming through your county and not coming out alive? What brings them there? What are the dynamics that leads to these deaths?
Well, actually, all this transversing back through the South Texas probably occurred back in 2008 when CBP, they reinforced their resources in Arizona. So they filtered back to South Texas. And in South Texas, it's just so, it has more vegetation, more cover for them, a lot of private land too. So it's not as easy accessible as you would the lands, the ranch lands of Arizona. So that's what created this issue. And then we have a checkpoint, one of the busiest checkpoints in the Southwest Corridor. And recently it got redeveloped to 8 lanes. So it's like another port of entry, you know, 65, 70 miles inland. In order for them to circumvent that, they got to walk. They got to walk through the ranch lands, private ranch lands. And that's the issue that was created.
This checkpoint's on 281?
The checkpoint is on 281, yes, sir.
Right. So this is a highway that's very familiar to all of us in Central Texas. It's in these parts, it's a beautiful landscape. I think we'd all agree. It's a very pleasant, appealing place. Lots of development on it. Can you give us a sort of a physical picture of what it looks like in the area as you're approaching that checkpoint?
Well, actually, Brooks County is really a lot of loose sand. We have sand dunes that you really can't see from the roadway. You actually have to get off and start walking in and inward, either east or west, and you see sand dunes. Just like you, it's coastal, right? We're only maybe 100 feet above sea level, so it's a lot coastal. Vegetation is always real thick for concealment, a lot of ranch land. So that helps them to conceal themselves from CBP.
Is there a lot of water, a lot of freestanding water, tanks, pools, creeks?
There are water tanks, water troughs, et cetera. But what they do, they usually don't use that water at times. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So it varies on the group as to who's guiding them through.
Stephanie, who are these people who are dying in Brooks County? What does the data show us?
Yeah, so in the past 10 years, 650 people, actually more now, more than 650 people have died in Brooks County. And when I first opened the binders and started looking through, I think I went in with an outdated assumption of who I would find. I thought that there would be a lot of men, and there are a lot of men. But as I was flipping through the files, I came across more and more women. And that was, for me, the impetus of what kind of drew me to what I eventually ended up doing, which was with the cooperation and with the help of support of Sheriff Martinez, going through each of these files and putting them into a database to really start to get a sense of the answer to your question, which was my biggest question: who are these people? Who are these 650 people who have died in this county? Who are they? And again, a little bit more about why they chose to do this, if that would be possible. What I found is for the first, from 2009 to 2014, women made up about between 20 and 40% of all of the human remains that were discovered. After 2015, the number went down to closer to 14 and 15% and has stayed there since then. In the first years as well, most of the people who were coming were Mexican. But around 2015, again, there was a shift and there were more Central Americans. Until last year, 2018, 3/4 of all the remains that were found in Brooks County that could be identified with a nationality were linked to a Central American country. There are also so many, I mean, what struck me the most is that there's no one profile of who these people are. There's minors, there's people who are in their 60s, there's people from mostly Central America and Mexico, but also people coming from places as far away as China. So there's really this huge variation in the people who are crossing through Brooks County and who are dying there.
You talk about building a database, and you've got a bunch of variables that you're tracking. Can you kind of emphasize which ones stand out as the most important variables? I think you have something like 45 variables or
58.
50 plus variables. So what sorts of things are you tracking?
So we're actually using all of the case files that Sheriff Martinez and his team put together. And so we based our variables off of the types of information that they were collecting. So we collect information on where the body was found, who found the body. We also collect if they have an identification on them, where they're from, their age, their gender. We collect what they're wearing, the types of clothing, and then all of the different things that they carry with them that we can identify. What is the most impactful? From a data perspective of understanding who people are, the identifying factors help to give a sense. But in terms of seeing people as people, it's often what they carry with them that's the most impactful.
We were talking about this earlier. The famous, at least sometimes Austin-based author Tim O'Brien has this famous book, The Things They Carried. Maybe some of y'all are familiar with this book, capturing the idea that these incredible insights flow from knowing about what's in somebody's pocket litter, what they're carrying with them, especially in extreme situations where it's just you, like a soldier in Vietnam for him. The things these people carry tell a real story about who these people really are. Sheriff, many times you're the one recovering the body, but in any event, you're also seeing the end result of this. Can you, whether talking about the things they carried or talking about other aspects of this, can you help shine the light on this in a way that shows that these aren't just statistics, but every one of them a human soul, just like us, and just like everybody in this audience, with their own rich story of their life and their hopes and dreams? What have you seen about these actual human beings?
Well, it varies. I think every body that we have recovered, any recovery, there's a story behind it. In fact, I've had a couple of stories that I can share real quick, like that 65-year-old gentleman that was coming through had a kind of like a brand new pair of boots. He had gone to Mexico for a funeral, and he decided to walk back across. He'd been in Dallas for maybe 30, 35 years or more. Well, I'm recovering the body. His wife is at the office looking for him. So once I get him to the funeral home, I brought the wife and the children over and the grandkids. Of course, the wife and the son identified him, so I just released the body to them. They carried him back to Dallas for burial. He's been in the United States for 35 years and not a citizen yet. So that's difficult to understand why it would take so long to become a citizen of the United States. The other story was a 20-year-old that I picked up. Back then, we had these phones that are called Nextels, had a little push-to-talk.
The ones you beep?
Yes, you push it in there. So I got the number, I pressed it, and a female answered at the other side. So in Spanish, going back and forth, I told her what I had and identified the gentleman on the ground. That was her son that she's been looking for 7 days. So I said, well, we're going to secure him. This is what you got to do. And this is where the body's going to just get hold of your consulate. They'll link up with the medical examiner, and you'll get your body back. So she was very grateful. Of course, she was crying, but grateful that the body was recovered. He's been missing for about 7 days or so. He wasn't totally decomposed. There was enough there that I would filter as a full body, and he got sent back to Mexico. So, you know, it's just little stories, and I can go on with stories because there's plenty of that, you know. And in terms of the project that she was doing, when she first brought it up, and I asked her, are you sure you want to do this? Because she was only looking at 2018 book. And so we were going back and forth, and she says, yeah, I want to do this whole project. So I started bringing books out from 09, 10. In 2012, we had 129 bodies that 1 year. So thanks to her and her colleagues that helped her, it was just a detailed report that needs to be looked at. With all the females, even temperature of the day, that has to do a lot with. Well, one of the main factors is that they're being held at a stash house in the valley, in the McAllen, Rio Grande Valley sector, and you got maybe 200 or 300 in the house. Yeah, they're not being fed. There's no water, and then they're being shipped north, thinking that it's going to be an hour walk, and actually it becomes 2-3 days walk. Okay, so they're not equipped for the walk, for number one. So that becomes a bad issue for them, and them not knowing. And she's right. The death don't discriminate against any age. This was a 20-year-old young man and then a 65-year-old man. So it's one of those things that it doesn't discriminate. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you. It's just one of those things.
What's the age range we're looking at here among these victims?
It goes from 15 to 69 in the database and everything in between.
So what details have stood out to you in the real lives of these people?
Well, I was going to follow up with one of the things that came out in the data that builds off of what Sheriff Martinez was saying, is that people do make this journey and they are completely unprepared for the realities of what they face. So one of the details that stuck out the most to me were the shoes that people were found wearing. You had, again, this grandfather who was found in cowboy boots. And this is rough terrain. They're going to be out there for multiple days, and it's cowboy boots. And another man from Guatemala had dress shoes on. And you had a woman with these very kind of fancy felt booties that were more high fashion than meant for hiking through sand dunes. And I think those details of not being prepared, either because they had no knowledge of what was happening, or even if they realized in the moment, no ability then to be able to go get more adequate clothing and footwear. But these are people who are out there trying to make it, you know, miles and miles through bad conditions with clothing that was absolutely not suited. And then on the flip side, even when people do have clothing that's suited, so thick jeans or hiking boots, they're in 100 degree or more heat with long sleeves. And that's suited because they're hiking through areas with cactuses or with, you know, spikes. So you want to be covered so you don't get your body scratched, exposed skin. But at the same time, then you are in a full outfit in 100 degree temperature, and you're also then going to heat up faster. So just for me, the clothing and having clothing that's not breathable, that was really heartbreaking to see that in so many of the case files.
So I think it's important, so people need to understand how unique it is that the Brooks County Sheriff's Office even has this information, let alone that there would then be this openness to getting objective academic research done around it. Why do you have this information, and is it different with some of the other offices?
Well, it is, because a lot of it has to do with the fact that I like factual issues. I like to know what's occurring, what's happening, and I will never turn down anyone that wants to come and do some voluntary work, right? And those are important because you really, the efforts you put into it really helps us at the end of the day to find out what occurred at the time, you know, and then the medical examiner doing their part on examinations. So it all compiles to the fact, like females that layer up a lot, they layer up a lot because they know the possibility of getting raped as they're coming through the brush. So they layer up a lot. And either it's too cold or it's too hot. You know, South Texas weather, you can get a cold front that's just going to, you know, in South Texas, 40 degrees is real cold. You know, it's cold for me at 60. So, you know, so it's just one of those issues that you deal with. But the fact that they've helped a lot in details, and that's the key. And a lot of it has to do with the sheriff really collaborating, as I do with a lot of other agencies, whether it be CBP, ICE, or any federal government, or private sector in this case, right? Because it's important that we get details as to what occurs.
Stephanie, you mentioned that over time, I think you mentioned either now or when we were talking earlier, that you'd expected to find mostly a profile of younger males. And what seemed to jump out at you first the most was the gender diversity of who was in this pool of people. But you also mentioned that in many cases, it's even more tragic than just the death, especially for the female victims. Can you shed some light on that?
Yes. So perhaps the most difficult files to go through in all of the file, all 650 files that Sheriff Martinez has, and they're all difficult, are the handful of women who were clearly sexually assaulted and then likely murdered, and then their bodies were found. And that's the most extreme gendered risk that you have when you're out there alone. I mean, that's the worst case scenario. But there are so many other risks that women face. And I think of including going back to the clothing and what the sheriff was mentioning, often among all the people who are out there, and there were a lot of people who were wearing clothing that wasn't suited for this hike, the women were often the ones wearing the least suited clothing. So they might be found on a day where it's 100 degrees and they have three layers of spandex pants on that are not breathable. And they'll be wearing then a long sleeve shirt and a jacket. And in men found, we might be wearing jeans, but three layers of spandex pants. I mean, it's just, there are so many things that women do to protect themselves or because they don't have access to certain things. And so the risks that they're facing compared to men are higher. And that is likely why we see more deaths of women. It's probably not that there were 20 to 40% women walking the trails when they made up that number of deaths. It's likely that the deaths of women in Brooks County are higher because the risks are higher for women. But it's difficult to know the exact number.
Sheriff, how have things changed over time, both during the period where the data is available, but just more generally? What do you see as the biggest patterns that people should be aware of?
Well, the biggest thing that I've seen thus far is that through the collaboration, though, we do have some water stations out there in the brush. We do have placards, probably approximately over 80 placards.
What are the placards do?
Placards are just a simple placard that reads, you know, dial this number, you know, and give us the identification numbers in the bottom, and that tells CBP, Border Patrol, where they're at.
So somebody who's in distress would see this and figure out who they can call?
Exactly. And then you have your beacons, you know, and the beacons are also lettered in Chinese. So there's certain languages there, also specific languages.
Why Chinese?
Because we do have some that have come across through the brush, the Chinese. So it's just those components and everything else that comes with it. But there's been a lot of better practices put into place. It took us a while because it kind of caught us off guard. You know, in 2008, we hardly had anyone out there. And, of course, that's when the whole shift started of the pedestrians walking through. So it's just one of those issues that collaboration helps a lot. And we need to understand that it's just a fact and it's happening.
You mentioned that someone who's in distress who's willing to make that call, that'll be the end of their journey probably, but they might do it. Will they get cell phone coverage out there? How does that work?
I'm glad you asked that. They don't have phone coverage. In fact, we're along with Border Patrol, we're also trying to get the phone companies to put new towers out there because the triangulation is real hard, difficult. They're within 5 to 10 miles of where they're at. And then once they make that call and we triangulate it, they'll start moving. And it's very hard for us to find them. So we emphasize to turn their phones off and stay put, you know. But they're in that desperate mode that, okay, they're never going to get here. But because of everything that's been implemented, there's been over 500 to 600 rescues in Brooks County alone because Border Patrol also provides EMT personnel, helicopter personnel, and they'll just go get them and apply IVs if needed. And, of course, they'll go straight to the hospital if they need to go there. Or they'll get the medical treatment they need before anything else occurs.
Do we have the resourcing of person power that's necessary at that distance from the border, given all the things that have been happening closer to the border? Has that had an impact on how many people are available in your county in that area to work on these issues?
That's correct. Because recently here, though, they're shifting a lot of the Border Patrol agents that belong in the brush to the south to go work on the detention centers, all right, for the processing part, which leaves the brush wide open. So that's another setback. So I have always been emphasizing that we need to keep them there because that's just another line of defense. Once they get by Brooks County, they're pretty much inland anywhere they want to go to.
By the way, when they finish that journey, the smugglers, the coyotes, they got to pick them up again on the other side. So there's a smuggler, there's a guide with them, at least for part of the journey. When they get into distress, what happens to that person? Do they abandon them? Do they resist when a distressed traveler wants to place a call to try to get some help? What is the role there?
Well, what happens a lot is once that person gets injured, okay, the coyote is going to leave them there and tell them, don't call. Give us an hour before you call. And for some reason, they listen to that. They'll listen and call us at an hour. That gives that coyote and the other group, you know, leeway to get far enough away from that particular person. So that's what occurs, and it occurs often.
So, Stephanie, you've got a huge amount of data you're trying to wrangle. Are you doing it all by yourself, or do you have some helpers?
I have a lot of helpers. The first time I went through the data, I worked with Ellie Azell, all from the LBJ School. And this time around, I'm working with Sam, who's actually out there in the audience, and Victoria, who isn't here right now. And we are taking this project, what we started in Brooks County, of trying to make visible what is happening, because just to be clear, again, kind of the heart of this is that in a place that's only a few hours away from here, there are 650 people who have died over the past decade, and that's in one county. And so what we are now trying to do is to say, well, what about all the other counties around South Texas? What do the numbers look like there? So we're trying to expand it out, talk to sheriffs in those departments, to get a better sense of the humanitarian cost of or the human toll of U.S. immigration policy and what have been the consequences. To at least have that be more visible, and then hopefully to push for positive changes to have that situation be improved.
So Stephanie just mentioned the human toll. Sheriff, can you talk about the toll of this phenomenon on your office? And if I can ask, you talk about the toll on you personally.
The toll on the office, you know, when you only have one deputy working, it's very difficult to sustain your domestic issues because you have to spend some time on what I would refer to as a federal issue. Because what's happening here, these persons that are walking through the undocumented crosser or the undocumented alien, whichever term you want to use, if they get caught and they're alive, they belong to the federal government. If they die, it's a local issue, even though he's still undocumented. So from 2009 to 2012, the county itself had a price tag of $680,000 and change. Okay, so we're still trying to get reimbursed for that from the federal government. I always refer to it as work in progress because things in Congress runs real slow, right? So it's been 10 years. So we're still waiting to hear something from them. So I think they need to work on their policy, if they happen to die or they live, it still belongs. It's a federal issue. And that would, you know, they have more resources than we do, number one. And they can just as easy reach out to the local consulates like we have and collaborate in those terms. You know, seeing so many dead bodies, yeah, you become desensitized at times because, you know, there for a while we were picking up five or six a day. So, you know, and you got to look at them, each and one of them, and get it done, get the medical examiner to do the autopsy report. So the cost for us is no longer there because the state of Texas, through the governor's office, picked up the cost, the tab, from 2013 to recent to right now to current. So they probably provide almost $300,000 a year to the county just for the bodies alone.
So let's talk about how we can make things better. And there's a lot of different lenses we could bring to bear on that. We could talk about what Congress should do, what the ledge should do, what the county might also be able to do, what the public can do. Stephanie, what are some ideas that are already percolating in your mind?
Well, when I began the project, I was provided the binders on the basis that when I was done with the project, I would come back and offer some suggestions to the Brooks County Sheriff's Office on ways they could improve their search and rescue or body recovery efforts. Now, I don't know how great the ideas were that I ended up coming up with, but there's some small changes because unless Sheriff Martinez has better contacts in D.C. than I do, neither of us can at this point change the policy that's creating this entire situation. But at least on the local level, one of the things that became really clear going through the files for both search and rescue and for body recovery is that a lot of the people who were dying were still wearing all their clothes. They were still wearing their shoes, and they clearly must have had signs leading up that they were overheating. So in the data, when you look at when people are dying, most of the bodies that are being recovered that don't have decomposition, so meaning they just died, are happening between the months of June and September. So it's likely that if they're dying related to dehydration or heat exposure. And so thinking about ways, looking at bodies that were dying and they're wearing full clothes and hiking boots, and thinking if there are small fixes that somehow you could get information about if you are going through these steps, what should you be doing? Should you be taking off your shoes? Should you be pouring water on certain parts of your body? What are the small things that you could be doing? And my idea, and again, of course, there might be better ones out there, but was to put some type of signs of what they should be doing, infographics on those plaques that are around, or looking for information campaigns to get that information out to people. It's not going to make the big difference of changing all migratory flows, but looking at small fixes to try to improve the situation for people who are crossing through. I feel like there's a few more on recovery, but I'll hand it over to you as I try to remember which ones those were.
Well, as far as the recovery, of course, we have Border Patrol. Once they hit the 911, they're recovered. Like I mentioned before, at least 500 of them have been recovered. We got placards also for assistance. We have beacons for assistance. There's water stations out there for assistance. but without really securing that border between the port of entries, that's one of the main issues. That needs to be secured. Just to be the safe side, that needs to be secured, and it's not secured yet. As far as Congress, well, they're really not acting on it at all, period. They're just not talking. They're not having dialogue, and it needs to be addressed, because actually the ones that are taking the impact is the locals, like the local sheriff's office, the local communities, etc. So, you know, issues like that, there's a lot of little components that needs to be looked at. In terms of sitting down and talking about it, you know, not just putting a blanket over it, you got to separate issues.
What about, we haven't talked about the ranchers on whose property these people are dying. What sort of what do you hear from your neighbors about this? Are people upset? Do they want the government to do more? Are they trying to help? What sort of atmosphere do you see there?
The ranchers they collaborate very well. They understand the situation, because you got to understand this type of issues have been going on since I was around. You know, I'm 63, so it's been going around for a while. Not in masses as it is now, but the ranchers really do cooperate very well with local law enforcement, CBP. So they don't have an issue on it getting done. I know that I can sit here and say that property damage in local ranches, probably over $1 million already, just damages that are caused by them as they're coming through, whether they steal a tractor or they break a water trough or just leave the water on. You know, we just had an issue with one of them that broke into the ranch house. The owner showed up. They had a little wrestling match. The guy ran. We got there in time. We found him. And he had been deported twice already, okay? And he had done 24 months in federal prison for that. So this is his third time already. So that goes back, kind of tells you that we need to secure that border, because this guy was very aggressive. So we have those type of people. So that you get your transnational gangs that have come through. You got your drug trafficking organizations coming through. The human smuggling organs. We have all these components coming through, because the common denominator is money. Okay. Then you have these gangs that come in from Houston and San Antonio on stolen trucks to pick them up. They have nothing to lose. Okay. So they're not being looked at as persons. It's more of a dollar sign. Okay, so the more people they get to Houston or destination, the more monies they get. So we need to go after those that are actually pushing this. And that's just one of the issues that needs to be addressed also.
Just to kind of follow up on one of those points in terms of where to focus, I probably would take in thinking about solving this, an approach that focuses less on the smugglers, because I also agree they are motivated by money. But taking one out, because if everything else stays the same, someone else will slot in to keep making money. So it's this constant merry-go-round of just going after and after. Not that that shouldn't be happening, but I would put more of the focus also on changing the overall structure, because people are crossing now. No one wants to cross through the ranch land. If there is a legal pathway to get to your job, you would take that. You only are doing that, or if you could get back to your family, you only are doing that if there is no legal opportunity to get there.
All right. So the floor is open, and the gentleman right there behind you, sir.
Stephanie, I appreciate the kind of the context that you just gave. I think it's important. All of what's happening, whether it's in Brooks County or whether it's the picture of the father and the baby in the river, or people dying in the Sonoran Desert, all of these deaths are a result of deliberate policy choices that were made. And it seems to me that what you're talking about today is never part of the conversation when we're making these policy choices. So how do we, or can we, in a political context, take into account the risks that we're creating for people when we harden the border in urban areas, or, you know, with the sheriff saying, let's control the border over here? Well, that creates another effect. So how do we put this human equation that the two of you are talking about into that conversation?
That's a great question. And thank you for putting that additional context. I think from my perspective, the first step, and this is the step that I think we're trying to take, is to make it visible. There is a lot of coverage of deaths of people crossing the border in Arizona in California, and I think there's been a lot less in South Texas. I don't think there is a, and maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't found it yet, I don't think there is a widespread acknowledgement of the magnitude of deaths that are taking place. And particularly, people know, okay, there are deaths when people are crossing the river and entering the United States, but without the secondary recognition of it's actually the CBP checkpoints inland that are also rerouting people and causing likely even more deaths. But it's difficult because we don't even really know that statistic because we don't know all the statistics of all the people who have died, all of the migrants. So I think the first step, and that is my goal, is to make it more visible, the magnitude of the issue, and then hoping that it can factor in alongside these other important issues that a lot of you people have heard about today and in the news of what's going on at the border, what's going on with families and detention centers and asylum laws. All of these things are important, and so are deaths of people in Brooks County, and we should hold that as well as we look at all these issues.
But I would say that Congress knows what's going on. It's they know because they get briefings all the time, and they're factual briefings. So they need to address it. You know, it's very difficult for me to understand that you got a core of intellectual people and they can't sit down and have a conversation and have a meeting, meet a meeting to where everything can be resolved. It can. They don't want to. It's just an issue that I don't have a choice. I'm on. You do something wrong, I'm going to arrest you. Simple as that, right? I don't have a choice to say, okay, well, who do you belong to? What party do you belong to? No, it's not about parties here. This is about the United States not being secured. It needs to be secured. And they can have a conversation and actually come with an end result if they want to. They just don't want to address it. And I'm not saying having a cold heart about it. I'm just saying having a little bit of grace put into your conversation, and it can get done.
Next up, why don't we continue down the line right here?
Hi, I'm Rachel German. I wanted to ask if you're looking into similar counties, maybe even in other states that share geographic or national characteristics with the county that you're looking at, so you can compare perhaps people that have been found in those locations.
Yes, Stephanie. So we actually, with Sam right behind you, this is the project that we are currently expanding out right now, is trying to call other sheriffs and have access to their data, to their case files. We're also using the UN's or the IOM's missing migrant database. We're looking at the U.S. missing persons database. We're kind of trying to use all the different databases to get a holistic picture. The biggest issue that we are finding, and again, in other counties that are surrounding, there are similar issues, but it's so much more difficult because they don't keep the data that Sheriff Martinez keeps. And so they may or may not even have those case files. So we know this is happening in other counties. It's been a lot more difficult to get a clear picture of what exactly is happening.
Would it help if the state passed a statute requiring certain data retention practices, data gathering practices?
Well, I believe they have something in place already. I found that out after 2009 or 2012 when they called me up on it. University of North Texas called me up and said, hey, I can't remember what code of criminal procedure falls under, but you do have to track it. It's just not being done because they're just not doing it, right? So it's already in place because they actually use Brooks County to gather a best practice. So a book has been developed because of Brooks County. So yeah, we did it all wrong from the beginning.
Actually, if I could add in one more thing, in one of the counties that's right next to Brooks County, speaking with the sheriff recently, he said that they have over 100 cases from the last few years, but no one's ever gone through it and they don't have summary statistics. They just have it right now in a kind of in two shelves. One is identified bodies and one is unidentified bodies. And that is the second best arrangement so far that I've heard about in terms of keeping that data, because that means that they actually have those files. Most counties don't.
Well, this is a good example of where the university can make an impact for the good of the state when faculty and staff and students get involved in helping supply that. All right, let's get some more questions going. I'm so tempted to just pick on people in the middle, but we'll come back. Why don't we go here on the wing?
Hello, you talked a little bit about federal Congress. Do you feel like the state Congress has paid attention? I know they have passed laws like SB 4. They're I think in a lot of instances require cooperation with federal officials. Do you think that the state laws that deal with securing the border helped you or help the local communities?
Well, actually, they do. The state of Texas has really stepped up on this issue, implementing laws that we can apply in case the federal government doesn't apply, doesn't accept the case. For example, if they arrest someone and they only have two bodies with them, that they're smuggling, they won't accept the case because it doesn't meet the threshold. Okay, so that's diverted back to the office, and we'll adopt that case through the state level. So we do have those cases that were prosecuted.
Okay, let's come back to this gentleman in the back over there.
Thank you. I'm a current student at LBJ School, but also before coming to grad school, I was working for the Mexican consulate in Laredo, literally just working on the case of all the dissidents and all the migrant dissidents. We know that Border Patrol does a great job in rescue. We know that. They actually send out, helicopters, and they send all these EMT procedures that they have. Do you believe, and with your research, do you believe that giving more resources to agencies like Border Patrol that are solely allocated for, those rescue processes could, maybe help prevent these disasters, losing migrants' lives? Do you believe that more resources could help prevent that?
Well, I'm going to leave the research to her. I do know that they have applied, they have reached out to respective consulates so they can filter to respective countries about what they need to do if they're coming across. Okay, so the literature is out there. Again, you have to understand that these are not normal people that are coming across. These are people that are being transported by transnational gang members, which cuts all that off. Okay, so they're in the criminal element. That's why they don't get the assistance they need prior to them coming across, because they're within the criminal element. Now, they do know what to do. They tell them dial 911. They tell them what to wear, et cetera, light clothing. So all the literature is out there. I know that for a fact because that's been developed through the Missing Migrant Program. Okay, that was the oil at the Brooks County. So I know that for a fact.
So as we're giving more money to Border Patrol, it's difficult because, in essence, people are dying because certain immigration policies that Border Patrol is putting in place. So, for example, just take Brooks County. If you just ignore everything else, people are going through the ranchland because there is a CBP checkpoint. And so you have policies that create this infrastructure that pushes people into more remote areas, and then you give money to the same agency, Border Patrol, to go and save these individuals. On one hand, yes, investing, so all else equal, if nothing changes, yes, investing in Border Patrol and giving them more resources to go save people in Borstar and having people who are specialized paramedics going out and finding people, it would be a good thing. However, if you really want to make a difference, you have to go back. This is a symptom of a bigger issue. You just have to go back and address the larger policy that's creating this. Now, on a unrelated note, something that's happening, and this is a good example, is metering at the ports of entry. You have metering where CBP, or the Office of Field Operations, customs on the bridges, isn't allowing people to cross. They're only allowing a certain number every day, not everyone who just arrives. People get very frustrated. They don't want to wait. They can't wait. And they were crossing then along the river, and a lot of people were getting swept away by the river. And so then you need Border Patrol to go out there and rescue them. And so what's happening is that you're putting an extra strain on Border Patrol. Should Border Patrol then be getting more resources to rescue more people? Yes. But it's a problem that's caused by another CBP policy that's pushing people into those situations.
And we know that Mexico has taken a number of steps recently for its own internal controls of the migration pathways. Do you know whether we're seeing a similar displacement into danger effect within Mexico, people trying to avoid the equivalent of the checkpoint we've been talking about on the Mexico side of the border and having the same sort of deadly consequences?
Yes. So in southern Mexico, there's actually a very similar structure to what we have in southern and south Texas. They also have interior checkpoints about 100 miles inland. And there are people who do hike around those checkpoints. However, the level of corruption in Mexico is much higher, And so you end up with most people actually just paying a bribe to the National Migration Institute officers, which is Mexico's migration agency, to get through instead of hiking around. So there are people who have no money who are hiking around the checkpoints. It's very similar. But because of corruption issues, it ends up being that you see less of that. Now, in general, you do have more enforcement right now that's leading to an uptick in apprehensions. Again, though, the exact same point holds true. The people who are getting caught are often the people who don't have smugglers who haven't paid off the right people. The people who are not getting caught still, because you had, let's take in a couple months ago when Mexico increased its apprehensions, I think they caught up to maybe 19,000 people. At that same time, 100,000 people still arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border. So there's still 100,000 people who are getting through. Why? Those are the people who have more money, who have been able to pay more people, who have been able to move through the country. And those are the people, so most of them will be getting to the border and seeking asylum, whether families or unaccompanied minors, and there will be a group of adults who do not do that and who will attempt to go north through Brooks County.
It's a really important point to underscore that the data that you guys are gathering about the number of deaths is a floor, not a ceiling. There's bound to be some number of deaths that are bodies that are not being discovered. There's the counties where we don't even have the data. And then none of this begins to put our arms around those who don't die but make it through, although perhaps with a lot of permanent sustained impairment from the experience they had. All right, let's get back to the audience right here, and then we'll come here to the front row after that, and then we'll come back over there.
Hi, I'm Sergio Rodriguez. I'm a rancher in Brooks County, Texas, mostly southern Brooks County. A lot of the discussion about the remains and the bodies you're finding sound like they're relatively recent, like relatively new, a day, 7 days. We find remains that are often bones. So I'm curious what the process looks like for identification, if there is a process for identification for those kinds of remains and what that looks like.
Well, actually, we do have that process in place. Most of it goes to the medical examiner in Webb County, and then they'll filter down to North Texas State University, and they do the process. We get assistance from North Texas University, Texas State University, Indianapolis University, and Namus. So we have over maybe 300 missing person reports on file. So if any family member, the first thing we tell them, just go ahead and get the swab done and submit it to UNT. And we've done hits like that. We also participated on the missing day in Houston, Texas, in Harris County. And we probably write more reports in Harris County than Harris County does themselves. Okay, so it's just one of those issues that every best practices, I got all the universities involved, you know, including UT here. So everything is in order as far as Brooks County is concerned. I just had a neighboring county from Live Oak call me up. Said, hey, I got three bodies already. What do I do? I said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. So we did. We took care of it. So it's good to know when they can call someone and say, hey, I got this. What do I need to do? So it's in place to be done. So everything is being done. The DNA is being done. If we can, we even get fingerprints off the body at the site. Okay, as soon as we find them. So we can notify the respective consulate so they can start the process. Okay, because they're the ones that notify the local families in respective countries.
Thanks. Thank you both so much for the work that you're doing. I actually grew up undocumented, so this is a very near and dear issue. And so two things. One is going back to the human element, which I really appreciate you bringing that up and, you know, kind of bringing these folks to life. What can we as individuals do when obviously, you know, it sounds like Congress isn't doing a lot of the things they need to do. Maybe, you know, we can't really rely on the government for solutions most of the time. Can we volunteer? Can we donate? What would you recommend at the individual level? And then now I'm very involved in like the tech community and looking at it from the private sector. Have you thought of, because you mentioned you guys have kind of thought of some solutions that the private sector could bring, or maybe some of the tech companies with, you know, some of the innovations that we're having?
So the first part of that question about what people can do, my first instinct, because this is what I've been working on, is just letting other people know that this is happening. And this is why I was so excited that we got to even have this panel in the Trib Fest, to be able to have to share these stories, to begin to tell what's going on and who these people were. And again, in our partnership with Lawfare as well, trying to get out this information. And so sharing it I do believe that has to be number one, especially because the focus on immigration is on so many other populations. And again, not to say we shouldn't be focusing, I do believe we absolutely should. Just including this as well, we tend to focus on families and children and now stop talking about the adults, and that's just as important. On the second thing to do, there is the South Texas Human Rights Center that operates in Falfurrias, and they're the ones who are operating the water stations. I know they also run a missing migrants hotline, and they accept volunteers, accept donations, and that would be a great place to be targeting a lot of assistance and help.
The South Texas Human Rights Center, when they reach out to NAMIS, they're reaching out under my umbrella, Bruce County Sheriff's Office. And that's something I implemented back when, because I knew the need, and I didn't have the resources. So it's just like anything else. If someone comes to me and says, hey, I want to tackle a project, I'll find the most difficult project so they can tackle it on, like I did with her here. So, I mean, but you got to be open-minded. You got to be very objective. And it's a fact, and it's reality, and it's going to continue. So that's why I do that. But I even have some girls in California that do free volunteer work. They take missing person reports for me. And, of course, when they call NAMIS, they're under my colors, the Brooks County Sheriff's Office. So NAMIS knows me very well, and they'll just check them off as a credential, and they'll get the work done.
And I was going to add one more thing about having technological solutions. So I was remembering one of the solutions that I made as I was going through was looking at the GPS locations of where remains are found. And there are some clusters, very few. It kind of looks like a scatter plot, but you can find certain areas with clusters. And so one of the suggestions was targeting those areas if they haven't already been gone through with a grid search to be looking for additional remains because something seems to be happening. And it strikes me that there could be ways of identifying where remains might be, of using drone technology or something else in looking for people's bodies. That is beyond my capacity, but that someone with a more technological experience could be thinking about.
Well, Texas State University students that are working in pathology and all that that field, they volunteer to come to Brooks County for about 5-6 days, and they go back to the specific location and do some more searching. And they found bones inside rats' dens, because the rats will get that bone and they'll take it. Okay. So that happens too. That's something that I left out, but that happens. So they're real good about what they do. They're very deliberate what they do. So I assign one of the deputies to them. He'll be watching their back as they're watching down, okay? Because they got to look down to the ground and kick the dirt up to make sure there's nothing there. So that's happening, and we have made connections to the same body that we recover.
So we have 2.5 minutes left, and there were two people I said we'd call on. So we'll try to make sure we get to hear from both of you. First you, and then no answers, just questions or comments from both, and then we'll see if we can say something.
I'm Maddie. I am a current student at the LBJ School. I was wondering, what effects do you think decriminalizing the border will have on these migrant dynamics and the people making this journey?
Great. And then let's move the microphone over to the gentleman over here.
So I guess my question is, given, you know, recent developments in asylum policy, you know, the questions you mentioned about Mexico's capacity to launch any sort of, you know, sustained effort in regards to their own border, and, you know, what you'd expect to be the increasing humanitarian toll of those decisions, what challenges, you know, at the county level do you kind of anticipate, you know, at least being accelerated going forward?
1 minute total. Go.
So just so I understood that right, that is all of the different policies that have been put in place, what might the effects of them be on the county level? Okay, the most recent, so the asylum ban, MPP. You would think that when you put in place things like an asylum ban, when you make it more difficult to, when you close any legal pathways, which is the broad theme across all these policies, you are doing what has been historically done that show. Kind of, you have policies that are restrictive. It pushes people to more remote areas, and people die. That's been something we've seen for 100 years in terms of U.S. immigration and labor policy. Now, you can imagine that when you cut off legal pathways, you will push people to not go to the border and present themselves and seek asylum, because that's no longer even right now a possibility if you're not from Mexico. But you would hire a smuggler and try to get through Brooks County. I think that you're going to see some effects of these policies in rerouting people through more remote and dangerous routes. I don't agree, though, with people who say that you're going to see 100% flip of everyone who now you would have saw this now is going to be going through more remote areas, because they're different populations with different motives. And most families, their risk tolerance for crossing through Brooks County, they're not going to have that risk tolerance. They're not going to have that risk appetite to cross through. It's a pretty specific group that chooses to do that. So you will see some increasing numbers of people through Brooks County, but it won't be a whole 180 flip.
And with that, alas, we must stop. Thank you all for bearing with the muggy weather, and thank you to our panelists.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this week it is produced in cooperation with the Strauss Center at the University of Texas and with the Texas Tribune Festival, to whom we send special thanks for sharing the audio of this event with us. Our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan, who is not in Austin, Texas. You, who are probably also not in Austin, Texas, should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Share the Lawfare Podcast on social media, and also share Stephanie Loiter's incredible work on the challenges of migrants passing through Brooks County, Texas. It's an incredible series. Please check it out. Our swag is available at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer is the long-suffering Michaela Fogel. And of course, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.